and welcome to episode 7 of Divergent by Design, a podcast that is dedicated to exploring the ways that you can use universal design for learning in your classroom. My name is Jonathan Wiley, and I'm joined today by two amazing people. Let's start with Lynn Kleinmeyer.
Hello, everyone.
Lynn is back again,
I'm
as
back.
Always.
Back yes. again.
We also have special guests today. We have Lisa Klein. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, we're so excited to have you. So today, alliteration has struck again. You'll notice that the episode title is Language of Learning. And I have been so excited for this entire episode because today we are talking about language and symbols, which is the second component of the representation column. And so we've asked Lisa to join us to enrich today's conversation. And so, Lisa, why don't you take just a second to tell us a little bit about yourself, your role, your UDL journey. Give us some insights into Lisa Klein.
Well, my name is Lisa Klein. I'm an ELL consultant for Grantwood AEA. And I've been a classroom teacher for about 25 years, teaching both content areas and English language learners, ESL classes. And the way I see UDL tying into English language learners is that we teach SIOP, which is a sheltered instruction for English learners, and the two just tie together really well. So SIOP is all about making content accessible to all learners, and that's what UDL is. So I feel that the two tie perfectly together.
Nice. I'm excited. I'm so excited. So I'm curious, Lisa, tell us a little bit with your classroom experience. What was that experience previously?
Well, I loved it. I taught a few years of middle school science, and then I moved out to Southern California where I taught 6th grade, 5th grade, and 3rd grade. Hmm. And in most of those classes, I had about half my class were English learners and half were English only. And then when we moved back to Iowa, I taught just English as a second language. So when I did that, it was more of a either pull-out or a co-teaching situation. And I taught K-12, English as a second language. So I loved it all.
I'm going to ask an ignorant question, but you can answer it any way you want, I guess. But ELL, ESL, is that the same thing? Are these interchangeable or how does that work?
They are interchangeable. Yeah. ELL stands for English Language Learners, and that's really the preferred term right now. Mm-hmm. ESL is what we used to call it, English as a second language. But for a lot of our language learners, English is not their second language. It might be their third or their fourth language.
Oh, okay.
So ESL wasn't the best term for that. Now, it's still the endorsement that you get in Iowa is an ESL endorsement. But we usually call the programs either ELL or LEAP, which stands for Language Instruction Education Program. We have a lot of acronyms.
I know. We kind of do in education.
Yeah. We do.
UDL, SIOP, LMNOP, you know.
SEL, all the things.
Yeah. All the things.
It was my pet project one year to like create an app for educators where they have an A to Z of all the different acronyms that you could use. So if you're sitting in a meeting at Grant Wood and somebody talks about something, you're like, oh, what's CASEL? I know what that is now. And you can just do a quick reference guide. But
I like that list.
I know. I was like, where did this go? Because I need it. I need it on my phone right now.
It's going back on my to-do list. Okay.
Perfect. So we are so excited to have you join us because today, you know, with all of your experiences, I think about your science classroom experience and then, of course, all your ELL experience, thinking about language. You know, I am a self-professed word nerd. I'm a language lover. And so I used to always tell my seventh grade students, words matter. And they really, truly do. We are surrounded by the language and words, both verbal and written, and we think about the intentionality, especially my background as a former reading teacher, you know, you think about that intentionality of the words that are chosen by authors. And then you just kind of continue to expand that. You know, I found a lot of times the barriers for my students when it came to comprehension, it was really about the language that was being used. And so that unfamiliarity with the meaning of words, or, you know, not having that ability to visualize or connect those concepts that we were attempting to relay really had an impact on the success of my students. And so really trying to heighten that for my students, I think that's one of the reasons I became such a word nerd, that I just really recognized the power of language. How about you, Jonathan?
Yeah, and that made me think really about, you know, when we're thinking about language and communicating today, you know, when we're talking to students in schools and things, a lot of that is now digital communication and being able to convey those things, you know, through electronic means, I guess. So things like text messages and emojis, and the way my kids text me and communicate with me is a lot different from the way I would communicate with my wife and things like that. And I sometimes have to ask them, what does this mean? Because yeah, the language is one of those things that's always evolving, and we're always adding new words to the dictionary. And
it's really fascinating, the part that you just talked about, you know, the communication with your kids versus your spouse, and just even things like the use of punctuation. Once again, as a former ELA teacher, punctuation matters.
Yeah.
And so, like, if I have an exclamation mark, you know, I mean, that's just my typical, like, I'm excited about things, but it says a lot if I don't put an exclamation mark on something. I mean, read into, and apparently Lynn's a little upset with you because there's no exclamation marks there, or if there's a lack of punctuation.
I'm going to go back and look at my text messages from Lynn now and see what
see
I have.
See if you're in all caps.
Yeah.
So far, you're not in the doghouse. I am not mad at you. So, you know, but I also think about the use of emojis. And I think that's one of the things I love the most about this particular component of the UDL framework. When you look at these guidelines, really, it's this component is about language and symbols. And so you think about all of the ways that we convey meaning. You know, I was talking about words, but that's just part of the way that we communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And I really love that they dive into this symbolic representation of language too. We convey meaning in graphic or visual representations. In fact, that was actually what my master's dissertation was on, is logographic cues in comprehension. So, I mean, apparently they're speaking my love language right there, but, you know, I communicate using emojis all the time. And so thinking about the complexity of the way we communicate and really helping to scaffold and support our students.
So, Lisa, I'm going to pull on that thread a little bit further, because we have crafted the most fantastic three-part question for you here. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
First part thinking about is like that spoken language part. So what are some things that maybe we need to be mindful of our classrooms when we're thinking about spoken language?
One of the things we have to be most careful of is watching the rate of our speech. We tend to speak really quickly in America.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and this is difficult for all kids, not just for the English learners. So one of the best things you can do to support language learners in your classroom is to really watch your rate of speech. You want to slow down, not unnaturally so, and think about, instead of pausing between words, you pause between phrases. This gives kids time to process what you're saying. A lot of our ELL kids are translating in their head as we're speaking. So if we can slow our rate of speech, that can really support their learning of our spoken language. Another thing that is important is thinking about this 10 to 2 ratio. Mm. Research tells us that for every 10 minutes of teacher talk, there should be 2 minutes of processing time. And I did not do this when I was a science teacher. I could go on for a very long time with a lecture. But it's really important that we give our kids processing time between ideas. Whether that processing time is verbal, whether they can turn and talk to someone sitting next to them, or they can do some writing, it's really important to give them this processing time. So that's one of the points that I think is really important. Another thing is watching your use of idioms, multiple meaning words.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
This is difficult for our English learners. They'll often take these things very literally.
Right.
And it's quite confusing. It doesn't mean you shouldn't use idioms. Just be aware that not everyone might understand those idioms. Another idea is thinking about supporting your speech with visual supports. So using maps, globes, graphs, word walls. I think word walls should be K-12. I think we should have vocabulary posted for all of our students. So just having some visual to support the spoken is hugely important for English learners. And I think it's beneficial for all kids.
Yeah, and I can give you a quick example of kind of what that's like in the classroom, because when I first moved to the U.S., I'm from Scotland originally, I quickly found that when I was talking to the kids that I could see them doing that processing as I was talking to them because of my accent and sometimes because of the vocabulary I was using. And I found myself having to be conscious of having to change that a little bit and modify it so that I was, you know, using the correct vocabulary or you know, altering my accent a little bit so that they weren't just constantly processing the words that were coming out of my mouth, because I could see that that was a thing that they were thinking about or dwelling on certain things that I would say or the way I would say it instead of, you know, we're further down the road and things like that. So it's absolutely a common thing, I think, that people can identify with or definitely make some very small modifications.
Yeah. You know, and Lisa, I loved all of these ideas that you just surfaced. You know, the rate of speech is always a really tough one for me. I am a very fast talker. And so it's something that I've been very mindful of and cognizant of in recent conversations, just trying to slow myself down just a little bit to give myself even processing time of what words are going to come out of my mouth next. You know, it's interesting that you're talking about like that need to comprehend or that need to kind of process. And I found as a former reading teacher with vocabulary, oftentimes I would actually translate myself, you know, just even like with the words you choose. I tend to be very verbose, and so I would find myself saying stuff like that and saying, I'm really wordy, aren't I? You know, and just scaffolding and supporting some of that conversation as we were going through. So, you know, those are all really amazing strategies that you surfaced. And you talked about the needing to make the language visible. And you talked about word wall. So, okay, here comes part two.
Okay.
You ready? Okay.
Yes.
So when you're thinking about the written language or text, what are some things that we need to be mindful of?
Well, there are a few things specific to English learners. One of them is thinking about what the student's reading level is, not only in English, but in their first language. Teaching kids who are literate in their first language is very different from kids who don't have literacy in their first language. And we're getting more and more of these students, these SIFE kids, students with interrupted formal education, who don't have literacy in their first language and are just learning literacy in their second language. So one of the things teachers often do is they'll strive to provide them just a translated text. Well, I'll just give it to them translated. And you have to be mindful, are they fluent readers in that first language? Can they read on grade level in their first language? So often a better strategy is instead of providing a translated text, to provide a simplified English text for our students. One of the strategies that a lot of teachers use is thinking about, instead of just saying, hey, read chapter 8 in this social studies text, really pulling out what's important. What are the critical pieces you want the students to learn? And that would be the reading for them. Or supports like highlighting vocabulary. So that they really know where to focus in. One thing I used to do with my middle school students that I found really effective, super old school, but was just making a photocopy of the text, and we would do shared reading, and we'd go through and read it together, highlight what was important, make notes in the margin, really support them through the text and simplify it for them. But just translating it often doesn't work for students. And that's where teachers go first. And it's great that they're trying to support the students, but it's not always the best support for that student. So we have to think about what supports that student.
You know, I love what you were talking about as far as some of those scaffolds and supports, the things like the highlighting, the picking out the main idea and supporting details that are really the essential pieces. Those are really great strategies that are so beneficial. I mean, they're necessary for your ELL readers, but they're super beneficial for all of your students because sometimes we make some assumptions of what our students are able to pull out. And so I love that you were talking about all of those different strategies.
We're teaching all of our kids to read academic text.
Right.
All kids are learning how to read a social studies text, a science text. But it's just more challenging for the language learner because they additionally have the vocabulary, they're learning the grammar, they're learning the syntax, they're learning that all as they learn content. So it's especially challenging for our English learners. So any way we can support them, through text is hugely important.
All right, so that moves us on to part three of our never-ending question that we have here. So we've talked about the spoken language, we're talking about written language. What do you think about the symbolic representation of language in our classrooms? What do we need to be careful or mindful about when we start to think about that?
I think one of the main things we need to be aware of is that symbols vary greatly from culture to culture. I think of math. People always say, oh, math is the universal language. Mm-hmm. It's not at all the universal mm-hmm. language. If you're coming from South America, from Africa, from Europe, the mathematical symbols can be very different. So thinking that we have to teach kids these symbols, and this, again, is good for all kids. As you're using symbols, be sure you're defining them, again, that they're posted so that students can refer to that, and then they understand what those symbols mean, because they do vary greatly from culture to culture. And also remembering a lot of our English-only kids probably need that same instruction as to what the symbols mean.
Right. Yeah, guilty as charged. Sometimes math feels like a complete foreign language to me as well. So, you know, just being cognizant of the mathematical representations, like you said, all of the, when you think about the greater than and the less than, and you think about all of these symbols that are used, sometimes I will look at my son's math work and go, huh, I do need somebody to explain, like, how would we read this out? And, you know, all of those kinds of strategies are super important.
Well, and just in mathematics, the difference between a period and a comma, it can be the opposite in South America. So where we would use a comma to separate numbers, they would use a decimal. And where we would put the decimal, they would put the comma. So imagine how confusing that is to students. So if you just define it for them, they can do it. But we need to define what our symbols mean for kids.
Well, and I would make the assumption that that same kind of idea goes to the written language as well, that there are different representations or different syntax patterns and things like that that would really mm-hmm. be something to surface for kids or yeah, be aware of as a teacher.
And especially as we support older students, these older kids who have an interrupted education, who are coming to us and they don't know our alphabet yet. If you're an Arabic speaker, if you're an Urdu speaker, our symbols for the letters are completely different. Not to mention our syntax and that we read from left to right and they would read from right to left. Just imagine what a task that is for them to learn to read in English.
Yeah, and I would even fall back to, we talked about emojis at the beginning
right.
of the episode, that, you know, even certain emojis can mean different things to different people. I think about, like, there's one of, like, two hands that are pressed together like that. And I think some people think about that as a thank you. Thank you for doing mm-hmm. this. Other people will say that's a please. Other people will say
that's a prayer.
Or something else. And so it really depends on context sometimes as well, where you're seeing some of these symbols. So.
And so, Lisa, I was thinking about those visual representations and thinking about the use of images versus things like clip art or emojis. Are there things that we need to be mindful of when it comes to those?
Yes. So usually it's better if you can show a student an actual photo of something, or we're so lucky today we can just show them a quick video clip to build their background knowledge versus a clip art or a drawing or like a cartoon representation. If you're trying to teach them, for example, I'm thinking of reading Where the Red Fern Grows and they need to know what a raccoon is, showing them an actual video or a photo of a raccoon versus of some silly little cartoon drawing, that can really make a big difference in their understanding and building their background knowledge.
Interesting.
And sometimes we put real cute clip art on their worksheets and things. Really, there should only be visuals if they're supportive to the learning.
Right.
And, you know, a raccoon in suspenders with a straw hat is really very unrealistic and won't support their learning in any way.
Yeah.
Right.
Whereas
right.
an actual photo of a raccoon would be.
Yeah. It's that ability to visualize. If you don't have the context or the experience with the word itself, that's oftentimes that background knowledge needs to be built in a way that's going to help actually convey meaning as opposed to just being there for the visual element.
And building that background knowledge can be good for all of our kids, not just for our English learners, but it's especially important for them. You know, even when you think about the little kids and you're going to move into a unit on a farm, when I say farm, we all get this image in our mind of, oh, that's what a farm is because we live in Iowa. But if you're from Africa, the mental image you get of a farm is completely different. So if we can show them pictures, videos, and support that background learning, it'll help all students, but it's really essential for the English learners.
Right. Well, and I even just think about that. You know, even the three of us sitting around this table, when you say farm, my image of a farm, your image of a farm, and Jonathan's might be different. So it just, it helps to center and ground the conversation so that everybody's on that same page.
Yeah, so we're getting into the weeds a little bit here. We're really starting to dig into some of the complexities of language. So what are some strategies that you've found helpful in particular for English language learners that could have a big impact for everybody? Because that's, you know, that's one of the tenets of UDL, I think, that, you know, it's designed to help specifically some groups, but can benefit everybody as well.
I think one of the biggest strategies that we have is using sentence stems, sentence starters mm-hmm. for kids. Language is really complex, and we want our students to be able to use academic language, but we often don't model how to do that. So sentence starters are a great way that support English learners, of course, but support all kids in actually using that academic language. Things like, I agreed with you when you said, or the way these two things compare and contrast is, as a sentence starter, can just get kids started in their language. So I couldn't have taught ELL without sentence stems and sentence starters. Hmm. They support not only their spoken, but the writing.
Right.
Using sentence
right.
stems for writing is huge. Sometimes, you know, they'll just sit and stare at the paper. They don't know where to begin. So just getting kids started in their writing, that's half the battle right
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
But I found those so helpful for students, and I left the sentence stems posted so that they could refer back. And it wasn't just the English learners when I was in co-teaching situations. It wasn't just the English learners who were using those sentence stems to guide their conversations. So I
right.
feel like that's a really important tool that we all have in working with them.
Yeah, just that ability to help organize your thoughts, because language, whether it's the written, it's the verbal, it could be the nonverbal cues. I mean, they all convey meaning. And so to help them, students gather their thoughts in a way that they convey their thoughts in a meaningful way, those are huge.
Yep. And it really models that academic language that we're hoping for. But we know students all don't use academic language and academic,
yeah.
and sometimes that register becomes very informal. So it kind of teaches them how to use that formal register of language.
Yeah.
So thinking about that language acquisition, are there vocabulary strategies that general education teachers could use or tweak that would really benefit their ELL students? Are there a difference between the vocabulary strategies that a general education classroom teacher might use and an ELL teacher might use?
Yeah, there might be. It depends upon the teachers. One of the things we know about English learners is that visuals really help a lot. So when teaching vocabulary, kind of as we were talking about before, providing those visuals for them, the actual pictures, can be really supportive for English learners. One thing we know as ESL teachers is that kids need to use that vocabulary in order to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just teaching them a definition. It's using the word, using it in context, using it in conversation. Another huge piece is helping children to put vocabulary into kid-friendly definitions. Copying definitions out of a dictionary is not teaching vocabulary. It's just teaching copying.
Mm-hmm. Can so, I stand up and cheer like, yes.
Couldn't agree
yes.
more.
Right.
Yes. All the snaps, all the hard eyes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. Keep going, Lisa.
It just has to be in kid-friendly definitions so that they understand it. And so it means something to them. And then allowing them to use that in their speaking and in their writing, circling back to it, keeping vocabulary posted. One difference for English learners, I think, that people often miss is that they don't need to just be taught those tier three vocabulary words. Everybody is learning those tier three vocabulary words, those words that you just use in that classroom.
Mm-hmm.
Words like mitosis and meiosis and chromosome, you really only use those in one setting. But the importance of teaching those tier two words directly to English learners. Words like justify, compare, contrast. These are also words we need to teach the students so that they understand the definition. And again, it's going to benefit all kids, not just the English language learners. So, yeah, vocabulary is absolutely huge for English learners, mm-hmm. for obvious reasons. Another thing ELL teachers do that maybe other teachers don't do quite as much is think about cognates. Looking for words that are the same in two languages or very similar. Okay. Yeah. Often if you just point those out to ELL kids, they go, oh, yeah, that is the same word. That can be really helpful for them.
Can you give an example? Cognates.
Oh, you put me on the spot. Okay. But like, hamburger is the same in Spanish and English. Hamburger, say hamburger, okay. same word. And if you just point that out, they can say, oh, that's the same. And, you know, in science, a lot of those words are Latin and Greek based. Mm-hmm. So they're the same across languages.
Right.
So, and also teaching word parts is really important for English learners. Teaching what prefixes mean, what the suffixes are, so that they can kind of build their own words. Teaching things like bio means life. If you see bio, it's going to have something to do with life. Again, good for all kids.
Right.
Necessary for your English learners.
Oh, that makes me so excited because that was one of my favorite things to do with my students as their vocabulary is to look at those Latin and Greek root words and prefixes and suffixes and just helping them to make those connections like, oh, and when that light bulb goes off. But I can imagine for a student who is learning English to be able to see like that connection and almost like a throwback to their native language just to feel a little bit more at home.
Yep, and honoring that native language too. And I think about when we think about what vocabulary we teach – I think classroom teachers need to really be aware of the amount of new vocabulary that our English language learners are learning, mm-hmm. not just in their class, but in every class and out socially as well. So really focusing on what is the essential vocabulary they need to learn, what is the vocabulary that they're going to use not just in your class, but in other classes. That's what we need to be focusing in on for these kids is making sure that we're teaching vocabulary that matters. So like I'm thinking of a novel and one of the vocabulary words was muckluck, which I think is some kind of a boot. Like they're never going to use that word again.
Yeah.
But there are vocabulary words that are useful. Those are the ones we need to focus on.
So not just doing words for word's sake, but correct. To really actually hone in on and circling back to what you were talking about, those tier two words that are those academic vocabulary that are going to help them unlock and understand what's really being asked of them in all of their different classes.
Yeah, definitely. And words that are useful and teaching them how to use those words. Word searches aren't going to help them use words. It's not going to teach anything. Maybe a little bit of spelling. But make sure that the strategies you're using are actually teaching, digging into words that are really, really important. Like if you're doing a word like democracy, that's a huge word. It has a lot of meaning behind it. They're going to use it again. Thinking about using a Frère model for that word, for that particular word, a word that's a big concept word. So, and again, that would support all kids, really diving into the big meaty words and vocabulary.
Can I pick up on something you said there that, I mean, it wasn't a throwaway comment, I know, but I think something that might be important or worth expanding on a little bit, and that's that idea of honoring their original language. Can you talk more about that or how important that is for, you know, teachers to consider?
The importance of honoring their home language cannot be overstated. We want our kids to grow up to be bilingual. We want them to be fluent English speakers and fluent in their home language for so many reasons. Socially, if a student, and we see it all the time, they become proficient in English, but they lose that home language. Mm-hmm. And it's just devastating to see it. It's so important to their culture, to their family relationships. Oftentimes I've worked with students who can't talk to their grandparents anymore because they've lost their first language. So it's really important that we as educators stress to other teachers, to the students, to the families, the importance of maintaining that home language. When you think about the type of learning that happens around your table at home, imagine your student coming home to you, your child, and you can't help them with their algebra, with their social studies, whatever it is, because you don't speak the same language anymore.
Yeah.
Now they've become proficient in English and they've lost their, say, Arabic, whatever their home language is, and you're not proficient in English, you can't communicate. So it is devastating when kids lose that first language.
Yeah, you have that problem, like I guess regular parents do at home. Like when my kids come home with their middle school math, I'm like, I don't know, I can help with that. But that's taking it to the next level again. It's not just I don't know the math. It's like I can't even communicate it in a way that you're going to understand how to help me or something. So,
well, and thinking about their social struggles, the social things that kids come home and talk to their parents, we hope, come home and talk to us about. If you don't have the same level of proficiency in that home language, you can't talk about these big ideas, these big problems that kids have as they move into middle school and high school. So kids are capable of holding many languages, and we want our kids to be bilingual, to be trilingual. So just because a student is learning English does not in any way mean that they need to lose that home language. We want them to maintain both.
Yeah. Well, and you think about the conversations that are happening with social emotional learning, and this language recognition and honoring is a huge component to that. And so thinking about how that impacts their experience both at home and at school, like my heart is just, oh, like that heartbreaking idea of not being able to communicate with your child.
It is heartbreaking. One of the things we tell our parents when the kids are in kindergarten, read to them in your first language. You know, we're learning about zoos. Talk about zoos in your first language. Your middle school kids, do algebra in your first language. It only deepens their learning. All of the research shows that the healthiest brains are bilingual brains. Hmm. So being bilingual is a blessing and it's a gift. So we need to really encourage families to keep that second language.
That's awesome. So, Lisa, what else do people need to know about ELL instruction or ELL students that are maybe misunderstood or not widely known? Like on this podcast in the past, we've done some like myth busting and things like that. Are there equivalents in the ELL world?
Yeah, I think one of them we just talked about is the importance of maintaining that home language, how very, very important that is to student learning. The other big idea that I think educators need to be aware of is the difference between what we call BICS and CALP. So BICS stands for Basic Interpersonal Communication Skills. This is social language. Okay. So if you took a language in high school, you were probably learning BICS. Things like, do you like to play tennis? Yes, I like to play tennis. This is BICS.
Spielerseeschlot. Thank you, high school German. I do play Battleship on occasion, so super
very
helpful.
So that's BICS, right? The kids learn BICS with or without us. This is like playground English. It's usually in context. You're usually chatting about something that you're doing right then. Kids and adults usually acquire this within 1 to 3 years. They're pretty solid in their BICS. Well, there's another whole piece of language called CALP, and CALP stands for Cognitive Academic Language Proficiency. This is the language of school. This is the language of the ISASP, of textbooks. It's very complex. It's a different register. This takes students anywhere from 5 to 10 years to acquire CALP. So sometimes we can hear students chatting in the hall about a football game or about a show they're watching or something like that. And they sound like they're completely proficient in English. And then they go into the classroom and we expect them to discuss the causes of the Civil War. And suddenly it appears like they don't speak English anymore. And the teachers are very confused by this, but they speak English. Well, that's because they have BICS, but they've not yet acquired CALP. And all of us are constantly acquiring more BICS and CALP, but I'm talking about in order to be on level with their peers. It takes a long time for kids to acquire this cognitive language proficiency. I think that's one of the biggest misunderstandings of ELL kids, is people will hear them speak and say, oh, they're proficient. They don't need ELL support anymore. Yes, they're proficient at BICS. We're working on CALP. And that's a lot of what ELL teachers do, is focus specifically on this academic language, the language of schools.
That is super fascinating. I had no idea.
Yep. Like, brand new to me.
Yes, Lisa, I'm just leaning into this entire conversation. This is so amazing. Thank you, thank you, thank you for teaching us.
You're very welcome.
I think that might lead very nicely into our challenge for this episode. Lynn, do you want to tell people what that is?
Absolutely. Okay, so as always, we have a challenge for you that this time we just have one because it's kind of a biggie. So we have a TED Talk that we wanted to share with you from Lyra Brodetsky on how language shapes the way we think. It is a 14-minute watch but it is super eye-opening. And it was the first time, just my own reaction to it, listening, where I started to understand, Lisa, some of the things that you were speaking of, you know, that some of those misconceptions about math being the universal language and that some languages don't have numerical representations, and just really thinking about all of the pieces that she talks about and thinking about our lived experience as the teacher in the classroom, but then thinking about the lived experience of our students and how, for both of us, our language is shaping the way we think and the choices that we make. So definitely worth the 14-minute watch.
Yeah, I think it fits in really well with what Lisa was just saying about, you know, you don't need to know what these languages are that your students have as their original language or their home language, but just be aware of, like, how languages are different, how they're structured differently. Just little things like, you know, I think there's an example in the video about how in certain languages you have masculine and feminine nouns. Mm-hmm. And I think she talks about how, like, the sun in German, I think, is masculine, but in Spanish it's feminine. And it's just very fascinating the way that language works in different countries. And it really, I think, it opened our eyes to how people communicate, and what we're hoping it will open your eyes to.
Oh my gosh, Lisa, it was amazing. Thank you.
Yes, it was great to have you, Lisa. I know I learned a lot, so I'm hoping everybody listening also learned a lot too.
Well, thank you. It was nice to be here. So.
Yeah, we could talk forever and ever, and hopefully we continue the conversation. And for you listeners, we hope that this challenge and the episode itself have provided you with some grounding and are going to help you keep growing. Our music for the podcast is What's the Angle by Shane Ivers of SilvermanSound.com and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 international license.